The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running on another week of broadcasting here at KPCG and the live stream at kpcg.fm. We're coming right down to the finish line for this semester of the Armstrong College school year. We had our ladies' night event last night here at Edstone, just down the road in at a golf course at Henley. Some wonderful speeches, lots of fun and fellowship over a fine meal. So we've got lots of other end-of-the-year activities coming up over the next 2 weeks. Quick update on the pack in Cardiff. We've got 89 registered for the first night, June 2nd, and then 67 for the second night. On today's program, we're going to be talking here in just a bit about the escalation of violence in Gaza over the weekend. We'll be talking with our very own Brent Nagtegal in Jerusalem, who, as it happens, got caught up in some of that, I don't want to say excitement, because there were quite a few people running for cover in the south of Israel. So we'll get Brent's take on that here in just a moment. Because we go first thing on Friday morning, Friday morning, I guess, U.S. time, it's the middle of the day here, but following the show on Friday, there were quite a few items in the news about the economic resurgence in the U.S. The USA Today wrote about the unemployment figure and how that it's at a 49-year low. You have to go back to December of 1969 to read about or to learn about an unemployment rate as low as what we're seeing today. So many Americans flooding into the workforce. There's, of course, there's also, if you scratch beneath the surface of some of these figures, you see that there are still many who've just kind of, they've bowed out of the workforce entirely, relying solely on government handouts. But that said, you can't deny the fact that there are more people also lining up for an increasing number of jobs that are available. This clip from the New York Post that we got in the news stack today, President Trump hailing the unbelievable economy, as he puts it, amid this historic jobs report. I saw a clip over the weekend, Jake Tapper, who was kind of questioning another Democrat about who should get credit for this economy. Well, shouldn't you give a little more credit to the president, he said. Even Jake Tapper has to acknowledge this. This article from the Post says business is booming in the U.S. as a record number of Americans are getting back to work. It says the nation's economy got another rave review on Friday as the latest April jobs report showed businesses added 263,000 jobs, dipping the unemployment level to a five-decade low of 3.6%. I saw a tweet Friday afternoon that said this is how incumbent presidents win re-elections with figures like this. It's extraordinary, really. 3.6%. The country's unemployment rate hasn't been this low since 1969 when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first people to land on the moon. It's historic. What a resurgence. And you see the president's approval rating. It continues to inch upward, even though he's got so many enemies in Washington, in New York, in the major media, all along the East Coast, the West Coast. So many people that hate him, that want to do anything that they can to take him out. They want to destroy him. And yet the economy just keeps chugging along. Here's what the president tweeted over the weekend. He said, despite the tremendous success that I've had as president, including perhaps the greatest economy and most successful first 2 years of any president in history, They have stolen 2 years of my presidency. Our presidency, he puts in parentheses. Collusion, delusion. 2 years that we're never going to be able to get back. And yet, as he also tweeted, the economy just keeps marching on. Well, think of that prophecy. Again, we want to see that there is a real spirit world. Of course, Satan and his demons. Satan is the god of this world, and they know their time is about up. They only have but a short time left. Revelation 12 brings this out. But God does intervene to fulfill his purpose, to back his work, to finish his plan. Jesus said in John 4, his goal, his objective, his whole focus in life was to finish the work that God had given him to do. Well, that prophecy about the resurgence in Israel, God saw the affliction in Israel. This happened anciently, but there's a prophetic fulfillment that's happening right now. He saw the affliction. He saw how bitter it was. And it says in 2 Kings 14, and the Eternal said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. God saved Israel temporarily, but he did save them. And then he continued to warn them, just like he's doing today. We're going through one more temporary period of prosperity before the troubles really set in. And that's what the people of our nations, particularly the United States and Britain, that's what they need to know and understand. That's what they need to hear. This is the message that they need. You see some good economic numbers, but again, zoom out and look at the world at large. More escalation of violence. Another escalation in Gaza. How many times have we seen this play out? The president, speaking of his tweets, he said yesterday, once again, Israel faces a barrage of deadly rocket attacks by terrorist groups, Hamas and Islamic Jihad. The president said, we support Israel 100% in its defense of its citizens. To the Gazan people, these terrorist acts against Israel will bring you nothing but more misery. End the violence, he said, and work toward peace. It can happen. That's the president. He's, of course, working to roll out his plan for peace in the Middle East. It's not going to work. It never has worked. It's not going to be solved, the problem there, until the Prince of Peace returns to, well, that very region, the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. The president was referring to the attacks over the weekend. Terrorists in Gaza firing, I think it's almost 700 rockets into Israel. Imagine that, over 1 or 2 days, 48 hours, 700 rockets. And it all started at the end of last week, I think it was Thursday or Friday, when these jihadist snipers hit two soldiers in southern Israel. And so Israel responded, and then you see all of these rockets being fired into Israel. I think the Iron Dome defense, Israel's defense system, they've taken out something like 240 or 250 rockets, but it's impacted. It's had a profound impact on the south in Israel. 210,000 children have had school canceled. It says here in the Times of Israel, military, the IDF says it hit more than 220 targets in raids, including cross-border attack tunnel, underground Hamas rocket production facility. It says the Israeli military sent an additional tank brigade to the Gaza border on Sunday and prepared for fighting in the coming days. So both sides are digging in their heels. Both sides are preparing for a major conflict. Despite what the military said was excellent performance by the Iron Dome, several projectiles directly struck houses and apartments or landed just outside them. And so I think the count now is 4 Israeli citizens have been killed. This is a sharp escalation in violence. The Jerusalem Post says, defiant Hamas and Islamic Jihad officials said on Sunday that they don't rule out the possibility that the current round of fighting in the Gaza Strip could lead to an all-out war with Israel. Says the warning came as leaders of the two Palestinian groups continued their discussions in Cairo. That's what's crazy about this. They were in Cairo in discussions, trying to bring together their sides, I suppose. And then their fighters, their jihadists back home in Gaza, they started launching all of these rockets. Snipers started firing at IDF soldiers. And now we're where we're at. Four people, all kinds of evacuations, sirens going off nonstop. Our very own Brent Noctegal, he was, I think he was on a media tour that went south, first to Ashkelon yesterday, and then, if I'm not mistaken, we'll ask him here in just a second, all the way to Sderot, which is right alongside the border of Gaza. He talked about some of this on his latest Watch Jerusalem program. And if you've listened to that, it's very NPR-esque, where he's basically giving you a running commentary on that bus tour, and then the points where he's able to speak with the IDF spokesman. But let me just first play for you the sounds of the rockets overhead, and Brent, together with other journalists seeking refuge at this home where someone had actually been killed just the day before. This is clip two. Stay low and close the door. And so there were those journalists huddled together. We have Brent Noctegal on the phone from Jerusalem right now. Hello, Brent.
Hi.
So you were in Edstone, what was it, last Wednesday? Peaceful,
that's right.
Beautiful, serene Edstone. And then you make your way back to Jerusalem just in time for this this latest escalation in violence. Maybe you could, before we talk about the significance of these events, maybe you could first just tell us a little bit. I know you talked about this on your program, Watch Jerusalem, but maybe you could summarize some of the events from your tour yesterday.
Yeah, so often when there is such an uptick like this, we will get a bus operated by a tourist group or a media group here in Jerusalem that takes us down to see one of the recent attack sites. And so that's what we're going to do first, go down and see this site in Ashkelon, a man's house that was hit just outside his house with a really large rocket and the shrapnel penetrating the walls of his house. And that killed this man that was really the first Israeli Israeli citizen that has died in the past 4 years from rocket fire. So this was pretty significant. So we went there first. And then while we were there getting an IDF, a briefing from the IDF spokesman, I was just recording a small segment after talking with him. And then as soon as I got done with that, I was out on the street, out on the front of this man's property. And as we heard just then, the siren started up. This was right overhead. There were rockets that I could see coming in. And then the Iron Dome system was very close to the house. And so I could see the intercept be made as I was running for cover. And of course, I knew this was a possibility that this was going to happen while we were there. But it still made me panic. It made me panic. I was out on the street. At first thought I had was, where do I go? Do I just jump on the ground or go close to a wall that's next to me, jump on the ground there? Or do I try and make my way inside, again, into the very same house where there were people that were there doing their week of mourning after the death of their father? They were in there as well. And so there was us and, well, there was probably about 20 journalists, the IDF spokesman, a couple of his aides, and the family that were busy mourning and grieving the loss of their father in there. And we did this several times. As soon as we would go back outside after a couple of minutes, there would be another raid, another siren, more attacks, more rockets, and then back into the house. And so that was, I guess, a pretty sobering situation for me. Hadn't been in one of those before.
Yeah, for sure. What? How did the family react? They're in mourning, and the father died just the day before.
Right. I've been trying to deal with that for the past day, just thinking about how this family would allow us all in there. Already, when we came to the site, when we were first at the location, they said the family's in mourning, so please be quiet. And I'm looking around the place, and there's probably 50 or 60 journalists, IDF spokesmen, police spokesmen, trampling through their yard. I guess they feel like it's important to get the message out, to show right. the world what's happening. And so the family allows us to be there. But when in the case of when these rockets come, I mean, the only safe place, I guess, was their house, staying down low on the ground with them. And eventually, though, they were after a couple of minutes were like, OK, it's time for you guys to leave.
Yeah. Did you go, was it from there, Ashkelon, then down to Sderot?
Well, while we were actually there in Ashkelon, just when I was running inside and during one of the rocket attacks, I noticed one of the spokespeople for Magen Adom. They are the ambulance and medics, paramedics that attend to the first responders that attend to different attacks. And I noticed the man that was with us jump into an ambulance that just screamed up on his brakes and stopped, and he took off. And so when we came out of the house, we then heard that there was another attack that had penetrated, or another rocket that had penetrated the Iron Dome that had hit really close to us. So we jumped in the van and went there. And at that location, there was a factory hit, and a couple of workers were seriously injured and then later died in hospital from that location as well. And then following that, we were going to go to a place that was really close. To the border. It wasn't Sderot, it was Nachal Oz, which is another kibbutz or community that's very close to the border as well, like Sderot. But then as we were going there, the road got blocked off because we heard that there was a anti-tank missile that was fired by Palestinian Islamic Jihad across the border from Gaza into Israel, and actually it struck a moving vehicle on a road. And so thankfully at that point I was like, okay, this is getting a bit out of hand. Let's turn around. We're not going to go and try and push our luck, which is good. If I knew I was going to be this close to the action and it was going to get out of hand like that, I don't even think I would have come on the trip. But that since I had gone on that trip, I am thankful for that experience, because it just bring a sense of sobriety to what the Israeli civilians are faced with daily. We hear about this type of attack where there's 700 rockets that are fired in 2 days, but every second or third day, they're heading to their shelters, wondering whether this is going to be the one that gets close to them, or maybe they're out playing soccer, as there was a photo the other day of this. A team was practicing soccer, a bunch of 9-year-olds. There's no shelter around that. So they're just diving on the ground in the soccer pitch, hoping that it doesn't get anywhere close. This is the reality that those people have been under for the past, I guess, 15 years now.
Yeah, and they're going to the press, the media there. You can see why Media Central is just so active and eager to get journalists down there as fast as possible, because, well, really, there's so many people in the Western media intelligentsia that they don't care about this story. All that they care about is if there's disproportionate force, and they'll be there to cover that. But for this, as you say, this is routine for people living in Sderot to have to go to the playground. In some cases, they're underground because they just can't even play outside like normal kids in practically any other community in the world. They have shelters everywhere. I can remember when I went down there with Jesse in 2012, we were actually filming a segment, and there was a bomb an Israeli bomb that landed in Gaza. It was in the background. It went off even as we were recording the segment, which was sobering in itself. But then I think the scariest part of it was just going back into Sderot that evening, and we got some dinner at a local cafe, and one of the I think it was the Iron Dome or something. It was basically a defense that it was right around the corner, and it exploded, the rocket that was taking off, thankfully, not landing. But it sounded like something was landing just right next to us. And to think about living in that all the time, and every once in a while it'll die down a little bit, but a few months go by, a half year goes by, a year goes by, and then you have this again, 700 rockets And then, of course, the citizens in southern Israel, they're just kind of lulled to sleep thinking that, well, this is our lives. This is the way we have to live. And if rockets come in, hopefully the Iron Dome will take care of everything. Well, we saw yesterday it didn't take care of at least those four Israeli citizens. Just a sad and tragic day. It'll be interesting to see how that this unfolds. Well, maybe we could just zoom away from it now. Again, I'm glad you, well, you'll probably get a call from headquarters to maybe stay away from this kind of a tour in the days ahead or the months ahead. But I'm just glad that since you were on it anyway, you did have your recording device going, because it does make for, it's just pretty hard to listen to. And you can hear that, but maybe you can tell our listeners when your program, it's posted, the first airing of it is posted on Sunday nights. Is that right?
It's Sunday, 10 a.m. when it airs back in Edmond. And then it's played throughout the day, I guess, a couple of repeats. But of course, they can just go to the website as well and go to the podcast tab there, or scroll down. They'll see it there.
Right. You've got Watch Jerusalem as a podcast at thetrumpet.com or at kpcg.fm. Also, just as another programming note, I think the repeat plays again on Tuesdays immediately after this program. So wherever you happen to be in the world, if you listen to the live stream, you can listen to Brent's program following the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on Tuesdays. So what are then some of the main takeaways from this latest escalation of violence?
Well, I guess there's a couple of things that we can look at. Right now, there are a lot of calls from even politicians and many members of the southern Israeli community. There's about 200,000 people that are underneath this this area that's very close to Gaza that could comes under rocket fire often. Basically, they want Israel to go in. They want Israel to reconquer Gaza. They don't see any solution outside of that. Of course, this was a policy to get out of Gaza back in 2005 that was instituted by Ariel Sharon, that it was hoped that there would be this concept that the Palestinians want a state, they want some land by themselves. Fine, we'll get out of the Gaza Strip. You can have it. We'll wash our hands of it. And then we can hopefully see if we can live side by side. But ever since that has happened, it's been taken over by a terrorist entity that answers directly to Iran. And even that's what's one of the significant points here. Whether I was talking to the IDF spokesperson, or even the police spokesman, or even reporting that's come out since, it's basically Iran that is behind this Palestinian group, Palestinian Islamic Jihad. We talk about Hamas a lot, but right now Hamas has no money and Iran doesn't really have the funds to pay them. And so they're trying to cobble together some temporary truce, as we see it, so that they can get money from Israel and others to just stabilize their rule. But then Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that takes their orders directly from Iran, they'd want to jeopardize that. They don't want any peace. They want to have war right now if they can have it with Israel. And so any type of peace deal is not going to be possible still while you have Palestinian groups that are allied with Iran. I think that's a very strong point.
Right. And on your tour yesterday, you were with the IDF spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus, I think is how you say his name. In any event, he's having an exchange with quite a few of the journalists. And in this next clip, you'll hear Brent asking the IDF spokesman about the connection between these terrorist groups and Iran. Here's clip one.
Is there any idea whether Iran's directly behind this uptick or anything in that manner?
Well, we see Iranian fingerprints on almost all of the hostile endeavors perpetrated against Israel. We see Iranian fingerprints, whether it is Hezbollah in the north, whether it is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard that is trying to entrench itself in Syria and has tried three times to attack Israel from Syrian soil and has been dealt with quite severely by Israel. And we see Iranian fingerprints mostly in the Gaza Strip, focused on the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but not limited to. That materializes in money, weapons, logistic support, military training, and of course political guidance. And the links between the Iranian regime and the PIJ, are very strong, and there's, I would say, almost total reliance on part of the PIJ, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, on Iranian funding and weapons. Almost all of the mortars, rockets, and missiles fired by the PIJ either were manufactured in Iran or were purchased with Iranian money.
Total reliance, the IDF spokesman says there. These terrorist groups in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria, they're totally relied on Iran, the state sponsor. These are Iran's proxies. And so when there's a flare-up, when there's an escalation, we have to step back and see the bigger picture. Who is behind this? That certainly is a big takeaway. Another one, as Brent brought out just before we went to that clip, it really does highlight, doesn't it, just the utter and complete failure of the Land for Peace strategy, which has been in play since the mid-1990s. And we've had so much to say about that at thetrumpet.com over the years. My father's written so much about the failure of this Land for Peace strategy. And as Brent was just saying there, you have more and more people calling for Israel to just take over Gaza again, to finally put a stop to this. It's been going on for a generation. Pretty amazing. Well, Brent, any other takeaways that we can leave our audience with today?
Well, one more I would just think is just really not looking at the number of deaths of civilians in Israel and stacking that up against the Palestinians and think that this wasn't a serious attack. I mean, we had 240 projectiles that were shot out of the sky by the Iron Dome. If that Iron Dome system wasn't there, those are going to hit populated areas. They're not landing in open areas of farmland because Israel doesn't choose to target them with the Iron Dome system. It only targets those that are going to hit populated areas. And so we can sit back and think, well, there's only 4 civilians. That's not many deaths. Well, don't forget that there's a couple hundred thousand people that are running to and from shelters with the fear of dying, other indirect hits. But then don't forget as well that you have 200 and something potential targets being hit by Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And really, if that wasn't there, there would be so many more casualties, probably with a factor of about 20 or 30 Israeli civilians dying. Israel would be going to war today, full out war to try and stop it. But now they have this Iron Dome system, this man-made Iron Dome system. In a way, the Israelis look at it as a godsend, that they can be protected from these missiles. But at the same time, it kind of numbs us to the actual threat that sits across the border. Anywhere else in the world, somebody fires this many missiles at you, you're going to war for sure. It also kind of does it kind of, in the sense of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, they kind of know as well that Israel has the Iron Dome. And so they have a false sense of security because they feel like they're not going to penetrate. Israel will protect themselves. And so they're just firing. But the stakes are just increasing, ratcheting up and up and up, higher and higher, when you have massive arsenals and just a defensive system that kind of works pretty good to protect Israel's citizens. We kind of forget about the magnitude of the war that is taking place yesterday. And if you talk about Hezbollah in the north, as the Contricas talked about, they have 150,000 missiles, some of them GPS guided, that can be hit Israel anywhere in Israel. And they're just sitting there waiting in their stockpiles. And Israel doesn't know what to do about them. The Iron Dome is not going to protect them from all of them. And so don't think there's only 4 casualties. This isn't a big deal. This is a huge threat that does face Israel.
Right. And of course, the arsenal continues to get bigger from both sides, as you say. It's even bigger in Lebanon, in South Lebanon there. And when you're talking about firing thousands at once or bigger missiles, there's only so much that the Iron Dome can do. Well, thanks for that, Brent. And be safe there. Use wisdom on your Media Central tours. I've been on many of them myself over the years. They're fascinating. It is good to get that message out. And it's certainly mindful. It brings us all right together with God's work, and I think helps us to better appreciate all of God's people scattered around the world and how much that we really do need protection in this time that we're in. When we come back, I'll try to tie in a few other stories that I think do relate to this latest escalation of violence in Gaza and South Israel. You're listening to Stephen Fleury and our special guest, Brent Noctegal. This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Last week in the New York Times, they are upset about the Trump administration considering designating the Muslim Brotherhood group as a terrorist organization. You've got the New York Times essentially sticking up for the Muslim Brotherhood. And in the New York Times piece, they describe the Muslim Brotherhood as a storied and influential Islamist political movement with millions of members across the Middle East. That's how they describe the Muslim Brotherhood. It says over at the Federalist, sounds like a global social club. Just some folks batting around ideas. This is the Muslim Brotherhood we're talking about. It says the authors didn't even have the decency to throw in a superficial adjective like controversial to create a veneer of balance. No, they're just right out there. If the Trump administration says it, well, we've obviously got to be against it. It says these days, this is further on in the Federalist piece, these days members of the Muslim Brotherhood advocate for child suicide bombings, political assassinations, mass murder of minorities, violent mobs, basically the entire deadly menu of jihadist activities. And yet you the New York Times will not, they will not report it as it is. In their minds, it's just like a social club. I remember what James Clapper said years ago. He said it was something like just a secular organization. Tried to separate it from even being religious at all. That thinking was steeped in the Obama administration for sure. And you still see evidence of it. It's in the media. It's still there. You're not going to learn the truth if you just read the column from the New York Times. If you just get an update from the New York Times editorial board. This is the context that the Times readers would not learn, the Federalist says, nor would they learn that the Muslim Brotherhood helped birth modern Islamic extremism. first to undermine nationalistic Arabic governments, but later moving into bigger roles. Readers would not learn that Muslim Brotherhoods spurred the creation of Al-Qaeda or its intellectual founder, that he was an inspiration for Osama bin Laden. They just don't learn these things. This is history. This is true history as opposed to fake history. Those that want to revise this out of the record, listen to this and consider it in light of what's happened over the weekend in southern Israel. It says also one of the Muslim Brotherhood's most successful offshoots, Hamas, designated a terrorist group by the State Department in 1997, still runs a mini terror state in Gaza and not only undercuts any chance of the peace in the region, and not only oppresses its own people with theocratic strictures and fascistic rule, but is also responsible for the murder of American citizens. That's right. They come after America as well. America, Israel, and then you have the New York Times rising in defense of the Muslim Brotherhood, rising in defense of Hamas. No wonder Israel is desperate to get a busload of journalists to head south to go see it in the hope that they'll report on it. Show the world what's happening. Show the world how Israeli citizens have to live day after day after day. No one tells the story. No one cares. It says the irony of all this is that the New York Times has a deeply ingrained antagonism towards one of the good guys. And it's when the Times turns to the administration's morally unambiguous designation of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization that we get a true taste of its hostility. Yes, indeed. This novel move by the Trump administration, we're told, quote, prompted alarm among American military intelligence and diplomatic professionals. This is what the Times reports. And then there's this quote direct from the Times, the piece last week. It says the potential problems included creating a need to grant huge numbers of visa waivers for Iraqi officials who interact with the Iranian military agency. This is regarding the designation of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization. That happened a few weeks back. And then the Times is saying, look, this causes a lot of problems, raising the question of whether American officials should start denying visas to members of other countries' intelligence services that use violence, including Israel. How about that? How about that? Moral equivalence between Israeli intelligence and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. That's from the New York Times. The newspaper of record, drawing a moral equivalence between Israeli intelligence and, well, a military dictatorship. As I say, no wonder the IDF, no wonder the Israeli authorities are quite happy to sponsor a bus tour to the south of Israel so that some journalists, any journalists, might see what's actually happening. You step back from all of this and look at the rise in anti-Semitism all over the world, in Europe, in the United States, and Britain even. Certainly it's there in the Middle East. Look at the neighborhood that Israel lives in. Anti-Semitism on the rise, it says that study finds. Violence on the rise worldwide. Violent, hateful attacks against Jews appears to be on the rise around the world, new study shows. The report comes following a difficult year in which 13 Jewish people were murdered in anti-Semitic acts of violence, while other violent displays of anti-Semitism were up 13% overall. It says there were more than 100 attacks against Jews last year. And then after that, the United Kingdom had 68. Then France, then Germany. Another article from AP, it says Israeli researchers reported Wednesday that violent attacks against Jews spiked significantly last year, with the largest reported number of Jews killed in anti-Semitic acts in decades, leading to an increasing sense of emergency among Jewish communities worldwide. It says further down, but the spike was most dramatic in Western Europe, where Jews have faced even greater danger and threats. In Germany, for instance, there was a 70% increase in anti-Semitic violence. Where is this leading? Where is it leading? In the Middle East. Where is this leading Israel? How does this influence the coverage? The media coverage? These are things to think about. I don't have time to get to some of these other pieces, but the stack has been piling up. This article here from the Jerusalem Post, 58% of Austrians believe something like the Holocaust could happen again. This is Austria. This is Austria, right in the heart of Europe. And there's a comfortable majority that say, well, I mean, I could see the Holocaust happening again. That's astounding. These are the kinds of headlines we're seeing now almost routinely. And then what about all of the violence aimed at Jews on university campuses? Higher education, the United States and Great Britain. Pretty amazing. It's building. It's a ticking time bomb. Well, that's all I want to spend on that, because I wanted to save just 10 or 15 minutes, if I could, for a little more of a follow-up to last week's programs. If you go to the trumpet.com website, you can get all that you need to know about the hearings last week with the new attorney general. That happened on Wednesday, and then we had a couple of programs on that. But in the course of just pulling together some of this research, I wanted to take you through the White House counsel's response to the Mueller report, and also, if we have some time, a couple of other things as well. So we'll take a short break, and then we'll come back and finish with that. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I mentioned that tweet from the president at the top of the show where he talked about the booming economy in the United States and yet how this collusion delusion has persisted right through to today, over 2 years of his presidency. 2 years that you can't get back. And there's no let up. There's no let up. He also tweeted this. This was yesterday as well. Also, there are no high crimes and misdemeanors. No collusion. No conspiracy. No obstruction. The president said all the crimes are on the other side. And that's what the Democrats should be looking at. But they won't. And then he says this, nevertheless, the tables are turning, and it certainly appears to be so. The Mueller report, it's been filed. It's been submitted. There is no more special counsel. The attorney general has decided that there is no obstruction of justice. The Mueller report itself says there's no collusion. And you do see the White House counsel. You do see the fact that there's still documents that haven't even been declassified yet. The tables do appear to be turning. And as I said at the end of last week, there's a lot of people on the other side opposite Donald Trump that are very nervous. They're very nervous right now. Or they just won't accept the truth. Hillary Clinton, she's on tour with her husband. It's not the most popular tour in the world, but she said just recently, this was a statement she made about, once again, the 2016 election, clip 3.
I think it's also critical to understand that, as I've been telling candidates who have come to see me, you can run the best campaign, you can even become the nominee, and you can have the election stolen from you.
She won't accept the results of the election. She's convinced she had the best campaign. She became the nominee. Do you remember how she became the nominee? She stole the election from Bernie Sanders. And then here we are, 2 years on, more than 2 years, 2.5 years from 2016. Convinced that the election was stolen from her. Will not accept the results of 2016. Now listen to this montage from Joy Reid's show over the weekend. She's at, I think, MSNBC. And here they're already talking about, I guess, Donald Trump taking over the United States of America, just continuing right on beyond his presidency. Clip four.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi gave an interview to the New York Times saying she doesn't trust the President of the United States to step down if he loses re-election next year.
But for Nancy Pelosi to recognize and identify that in this president he has these autocratic tendencies, but then on the other side to say that impeachment is improper, is just mind-blowing. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
The way we are going, who knows what kind of democracy will be by November 2020? That's the concern, and she seems to be missing that.
That he doesn't have any intention of committing to a peaceful transition of power, and he's got monarchists in his party who are willing to give up their own authority as Congress. They're willing to give up all their authority in order to be obedient to him.
So he's just going to stay right in office. That's what you're hearing on MSNBC. This is, if you've seen, we want to get into this later this week, all of these groups that have been banned by Facebook, and I don't know much about these groups. I suppose they are extreme kind of groups, but it is concerning just how much power these organizations, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, have, and they're deciding what's right and what's wrong. And anytime man does that, we always run into problems. But that said, how is this allowed on national programming? He's an authoritarian surrounded by monarchists who will not step down even if he's reelected. Or sorry, if he's not reelected. That's just news programming, I guess. It passes for news programming on MSNBC. It's conspiracy programming. It's conspiracy TV. And they're still obsessed. They're guilty of what they are accusing others of. You heard it in Hillary Clinton's comment, and you hear it in these news programs as well. It's astounding. Just going back to some of the economic news that we touched on in the first segment, it's incredible that this administration is able to even stay afloat. This response, by the way, to this was part of our research last week for those programs, and we just didn't get to it, but the Mueller report came out, and I forget the date, in April when it was finally made available. It had some redactions included in it, but this is a brilliant letter by White House counsel Emmett Flood is his name, and this is the White House's response to the Mueller report. This is before all of the hearings with William Barr last week. I can't remember when that first hearing was. It might have been around the same time when he said, well, there was spying going on. But it's just amazing to think that this was the White House's initial response about the special counsel office's report, or the Mueller report. It says here that the report concluded that the evidence prevented it from conclusively determining that no criminal conduct occurred. But conclusively determining that no criminal conduct occurred was not the special counsel's assigned task, says the White House, because making conclusive determinations of innocence is never the task of the federal prosecutor. Listen to how much this just makes sense. It's logical. William Barr, the White House counsel, they have the facts on their side. The rest, the others, You just heard it. He's an authoritarian. He's surrounded by monarchists. He's not going to leave office. He's taken over. It's a tyranny. He's Hitler. This is what they're going on. But listen to this. It says, what prosecutors are supposed to do is complete an investigation and then either ask the grand jury to return an indictment or decline to charge the case. That was their job. That was the job of the special counsel to begin with. You lose sight of that, and then you get into all kinds of gray areas. It says, when prosecutors decline to charge, they make that decision not because they have conclusively determined that no criminal conduct occurred, but rather because they do not believe that the investigated conduct constitutes a crime for which all the elements can be proven to the satisfaction of a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. It says, prosecutors simply are not in the business of establishing innocence any more than they are in the business of exonerating investigated persons. It says in the American justice system, innocence is presumed. Remember that? Does anyone remember that? Innocence is presumed. There is never any need for prosecutors to conclusively determine it. Is this where we are? We have to now prove we're innocent? It says, nor is there any place for such determination. Our country would be a very different and very dangerous place if prosecutors applied the special counsel's standard and citizens were obliged to prove conclusively that no criminal conduct occurred. That's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing with these kangaroo courts style of justice. People are having to prove conclusively that there was no criminal conduct there. Look at the way they're treating the president. Still, no underlying crime. The attorney general says no obstruction of justice. And the reaction, well, you saw it last week. The childish, immature, temper tantrum reaction. They won't accept the results. They're convinced he's guilty. And until he proves conclusively that there's no criminal conduct, really, that's already been proved, if you want that. But the American system of justice, it was set up. Remember, it was set up on the presumption of innocence. The guilt had to be proved. No collusion, no obstruction. But you listen to the news cycle over the weekend. What are they saying? Well, they continue on with the collusion delusion. This is toward the end of that Emmett Flood letter. It says, a great deal is said these days about the rule of law and the importance of legal norms. In that spirit, and mindful of the frenzied atmosphere accompanying the report's release, the following should not be forgotten. Government officials with access to classified information derived from counterintelligence investigation and from classified intelligence intercepts engaged in a campaign of illegal leaks against the president. Many of those leaks were felonies. Okay, here is a case where there are crimes. Crimes have been committed. The letter says they disclosed the identity of U.S. person in violation of his civil rights. They misused intelligence for partisan political purposes, and they eroded public confidence in the integrity and impartiality of our intelligence services. All that is going on. All of that is going on, even as the majority in the Democratic Party, even as the majority in the major media. They carry on with the collusion delusion. Mr. Flood writes here in conclusion, not so long ago, the idea that a law enforcement official might provide the press with confidential governmental information for the proclaimed purpose of prompting a criminal investigation of an identified individual would have troubled Americans of all political persuasions. That's what Jim Comey did. And Mr. Flood says, not that long ago, all of America would have been troubled by this. that the head of our country's top law enforcement agency has actually done so to the President of the United States should frighten every friend of individual liberty. He says further, under our system of government, unelected executive branch officers and intelligence agency personnel are supposed to answer to the person elected by the people, the president, and not the other way around. The president was elected by the people. Jim Comey, not elected. John Brennan, not elected. Andy McCabe, no election that brought him into power. Same with James Clapper. These are offices appointed by the executive. The chief executive, that would be the president. It says, finally, this is not a Democratic or a Republican issue. It is a matter of having a government responsible to the people. And again, not the other way around. In the partisan commotion surrounding the released report, it would be well to remember that what can be done to a president can be done to any of us. Well, that's the same point that my father's brought out before, and the president himself has made that same point. It's a dangerous, dangerous direction to go in. You can read a lot more about it in America Under Attack. However, there is a temporary saving, a temporary resurgence. Well, that's all that we have time for on today's show, but we've got much more. We've got much more planned for the week ahead. Stay tuned. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.